Okay, starting off the program this week, as we said, it is BizWeek Consumer Highlights. Starting off, Muftisab, the first topic that we have is who shrunk the marshmallows?
Look, Marana, this is something very interesting in terms of what we are likely to see in the coming months and even years, maybe, in terms of the sizes of products that are now available on the market. Over the last weekend, what happened was I was attending a very nice family function, and someone decided to be very generous and distribute some Kaylee's marshmallows to everyone, you know. Those famous individually packed marshmallows that children really, really can enjoy, and even adults really can enjoy. And it was something which is clearly not rocket science. You could see that the size of the marshmallows had obviously gone much, much smaller, you know. So we looked on the pack and we saw 12 grams, you know. And then we looked on the box, the packaging in which all the individual packs came in, and it says they 20 times 14 gram packs, you know, which obviously was proof then that the size had definitely been reduced, and the company were merely utilizing their old packaging of those boxes, which may have still been in their production line. So yes, the size of Kaylee's marshmallows has gone down from 14 grams to 12 grams per piece, and we are likely to see this trend throughout all the different sectors and different products, product ranges that are available on the market. If you just take a look at the size of bread, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that the size of a loaf of bread has actually been reduced. So while these companies may be telling their consumers or pacifying us that they are absorbing the costs despite the drought and despite a short supply of specific input products, the fact is that in essence, they absorb it, but also pass on the cost, the effective cost onto us by reducing the size of these products itself.
Muftisab, if in a case like this, I mean, you know, two grams of marshmallow for a child especially is 2 grams of marshmallow. It's a big thing for a child. But nevertheless, in a case like this, what recourse do we have? Can we contact a consumer ombudsman, or is there anything that we can do about it?
You can do so, but it's likely to be regarded as the consumer's choice in terms of the consumer. It's being read as the consumer willingly entering into a transaction after having noticed that the price is there and the grammage has actually gone down. You could try taking it to the consumer ombudsman, but it's likely to not go anywhere in terms of the clout of these commercial enterprises.
Okay. A recent article on teaching children money lessons. Children, you know, need to know the importance of money, how to use money, how to spend money.
This issue is something which is something most households grapple with, especially those households that are keen on imparting good values to their children, you know. And it's something that is, one would never be able to say whether we've successfully been able to teach our children the value of money or basic money lessons. What I found interesting was in the latest issue of the Personal Finance magazine, the first quarter of 2016, the magazine has a dedicated article, a very detailed article in terms of ways in which children could be taught the management of money. Many a time, you know, the article talks about how we teach our children control of time and how they appear and how they should behave and those kind of things, but we tend to see that the aspect of teaching them about money is very low on our agenda and our bucket list of teaching that we, or values that we want to impart unto them. And together with that, many parents are of the view that, you know, we ourselves are not experts in finance. We really don't have an idea of how to manage our own money. So we just muddle through and we expect our children to also just make it and understand money, you know. So according to statistics, I found it quite amazing, and this is, shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, that 3 out of every 4 rand of disposable income is spent on servicing debt. So that alone tells you in the country how much people are really saving. If 3 out of every 4 rand is going towards of disposable income is going towards servicing of debt, it already tells you that Africans have a lot to learn in terms of just this one aspect of saving. And then according to statistics, only 1 in 20 individuals in this country can afford to retire and still maintain the same living standard. 1 in 20 individuals. Can you imagine how where South Africa is in terms of saving and this one individual aspect of managing of money? In terms of the article itself, Morana, it talks about aspects of like avoiding credit, you know, teaching children how to avoid credit. So even if it entails maybe a child's money for the month has been depleted, and they have to take a loan now, but they have to take a loan from yourself, and you are able to be strict and disciplined in terms of managing that loan with them, you know, that loan arrangement, and I'm just assuming it's interest-free. But even if you get into a loan agreement with them where you give them, you advance some money, and they have to pay back that money, it teaches them how to delay gratification in their personal lives. Obviously, it talks about instilling the habit of saving, which I won't go into any further. And then it talks about what should pocket money pay for? And the interesting part here is, you know, many of us, we just use our discretion when it comes to allocating pocket money for our children. But the article talks about the correct structure of pocket money for your children. And what I found really interesting is the fact that the article is talking about when you allocate pocket money, you should budget for cell phone expenses, airtime and data as early as grade 6. And this is really, I mean, for many adults, you'll find that in a home, the grade 6 or upwards, even maybe younger, knows more about the mobile phone than the adult himself or herself, you know. So that is another reality the article talks about. It talks about sharing of wealth, teaching children how to share and to give off and to part with some portion of their wealth. And there are references to studies which have proven that children who are taught about sharing actually grow up with a much more, a better sense of societal values and the impact that giving has on the world at large. And then the final aspect I want to talk about is the aspect of how this article addresses being open about finances. Obviously, keeping in mind the children, the child's age, and what is appropriate for them at that time. And to be open about finances if things are difficult. Obviously, one has to be careful in terms of getting the children up in anxiety, but inform them about the difficulties of managing a budget, you know, why we cannot afford this month, but maybe we'll try for next month, and all of those kind of things. But just being open about finances, and if you really extend being open about finances even further, you can go on to talking about the need for having a will and your children having a will, and you also having a will, and them knowing about where you keep your will and those kind of things, you know. And obviously, you can do these things without having to say to your children that these are this piece of information I'm giving you, but don't tell anyone. You don't necessarily have to say that kind of thing. Obviously, if you are using your discretion in terms of the age of the child, it is possible to achieve these objectives.
Jazakallah for the Mufsab. I believe that there's a caller on the line. Is it okay if we take the call before we move on?
By all means, Mara.
Okay, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Okay, I think the caller has cut. You can call us on 011-854-1548. We apologize, Mufti Saab was busy then, we didn't want to interrupt him. So we will take your call later on. Mufti Saab, that is a very important topic that we have been speaking on, this, you know, the article on teaching children money lessons and the value of money, how to spend money. Children, very, very important to avoid credit from this young age, you know, not to get into that habit. Children often see their parents going shopping, and when they come to the till point, they just swipe a card and you know, put everything into the trolley and you walk away. And then the child wants something, and the father tells the child, "Oh, but I don't have money." And the child says, "Come, I see your wallet." And you open the wallet and you see no money. And the child very cleverly pulls out that card and says, "Derek, can't you just swipe this, you know? I mean, you swiped it for all the groceries. Why can't you swipe this for my toy?" So,
yes, it does.
Children pick up more than what we think they pick up. They know more than what we think they know. They know sometimes even much more than us, you know. There was even on teaching children the value of money, Mufsab touched on sharing as well. You know, there was a complaint where a parent complained to the APA. The parent said, in the madrasa, the parent said that, you know, my child is crying. My child doesn't want to go to madrasa. And when they were asked why, the child said, because my friend comes with 10 rand spending every day. And I don't get 10 rand spending every day. The child is actually crying. I don't want to go to madrasa because I'm not getting that amount. So,
yes.
Obviously, teach the child the value of money and spending money, pocket money, it's extremely important.
Yes. One of this article addresses that very point you're raising there, in the sense that it talks about how children should be taught that each family has their own individual priorities. And so one family might prioritize in a specific way, and their priorities will entail giving the child so much of money because having you know, all those sugary items is of some value, and it creates some kind of happiness and fun for the child, you know. But the priorities differ, and that is something which needs to be taught to children from a young age, so that even when they grow up, they do not give in to any kind of peer pressure that we find in society. Maulana, in relation to the first topic of the shrinking of marshmallows, we just received a tweet from Sister Rukia Ibrahim, who's saying that the Cadbury slabs have also been reduced, yet the prices have increased. And for the interest of this sister, I would like to mention that Cadbury slabs have actually been reduced twice in the past 24 months. So it was at 120 grams, it came to 100 grams, it's now gone to 90, and I wouldn't be surprised if it goes even less.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, something that makes you really think. Key points from the annual report of the Banking Ombudsman.
Well, the Banking Ombudsman's report was released very recently, and this report talks about a number of things. First of all, it talks about the aspect of complaints that were lodged in terms of the consumer experience with the individual banks. It talks about approximately 5,000 cases being opened during 2015. Of these 5,000 cases, approximately 4,800 were closed for some reason or the other, and 1,400 were eventually looked in or investigated by the ombudsman. So let's assume for argument's sake, the exact figure is 1,468, but say 1,500 cases were investigated by the ombudsman. Now, the interesting part is of these 1,500 cases approximately, in 20% of cases, the ombudsman found or passed judgment in favor of in favor of the consumer. The remaining 73% were in favor of the banks. This already tells you that in most of these cases, the actual negligence was not of the banking, not of the banks itself, but rather of consumers. So just to give you an example, there were cases where individuals, let's say an individual lost their banking card, and the card was swiped and utilized by some criminal, and when the matter was brought to the ombudsman, it was discovered that the individual had utilized a very simple PIN code, you know, a PIN code that anyone could crack. And so, for example, they had used the first six digits of the ID number, which is their date of birth. And naturally, that is if the criminal is aware of the identity of the victim of the crime, obviously that criminal is able to make hay with that card, you know. So simple issues like not having a strong enough PIN code is something which does not occur well for the interest of the consumer. Another case is that of not updating one's FICA details, because the Financial Intelligence Services Act requires you to update specific documents, and if that is not updated, or you do not give in to your bank's request for updated documents in terms of FICA requirement, it is possible for a bank to freeze one's account. And so this is again negligence of the consumer. And then also you have cases where young individuals have maybe immigrated or are inactive, their accounts are not active for too long, you know, or for long enough. In that case, the bank also has a unilateral right to close an account, but then there is some requirement to inform the consumer of closing the account. So these are just a few examples where consumers have actually been negligent, and as a result, the Banking Ombudsman has decided in 20% of the cases in favor of the consumer. The remaining have been decided in favor of banks. So that's the one aspect which the report talks about. The second aspect is the most expensive bank to deal with. And this is something which obviously is reputational damage for the institution itself. But although Standard Bank has the most clients in terms of its client base, it's more than any of the other banks. In terms of complaints, naturally, there were more complaints about Standard Bank than any other bank in terms of the Banking Ombudsman's report. What I find really interesting of the report is the banking institution that goes by Capitec. Capitec is really an institution which seems to be making waves, and is definitely an institution that individuals of the lower income category or even the middle or even upper income category should be considering. Capitec is definitely a bank that is coming up and is looking very attractive from a banking perspective.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you mentioned about FICA, Mufsab. Tell me, is there any rule regarding FICA? I don't think it's annually, but is it every 3 years, or is it just whenever the bank requires it?
I'm not too sure of this, but there is probably, in terms of the Financial Intelligence Center Act, there is probably a fixed period of time, which I don't recall at this moment in time. It could be 3, it could be 5 years. Every 5 years, specific documents have to be renewed, and recent documents have to be supplied by to a bank. And the bank would generally contact the client for these documents. If the client is negligent, in that case, it is possible for the account to be suspended.
Okay. Where are skilled South Africans coming?
One of the aspect of, or the topic of immigration is hot on in the minds of many individuals, and all I want to say is just highlight what I picked up in an article in terms of the specific destinations that skilled South Africans are choosing, and also the aspect of which specific professions are suffering the most in terms of immigration, and then thirdly I want to just mention our orientation in terms of immigration as we currently stand in this country. In terms of the first point of where South Africans are going, it does seem like the vast majority of South Africans are immigrating to the UK. First of all, that's number one on the list, Australia second, Canada third, Ireland fourth, Portugal fifth. This one is a real surprise for me. Item number six, country number six, is the Czech Republic, where South Africans are immigrating to. And you wouldn't be surprised if skilled South Africans are even moving as far as Norway or even Greece, for that matter. So yes, South Africans are moving to these specific destinations that I've just mentioned.
I don't see Dubai featuring on them, sir.
Dubai hasn't featured on this list. You are correct in that analysis, Morana. It only lists the first 15 countries. And Dubai is probably somewhere here, but not the first 15 countries that South Africans are moving to.
Okay.
It does seem like that Dubai, it's quite a good analysis. Somehow they haven't picked up the reason for why any of the Arab countries are not featuring on the specific top 15 countries that skilled South Africans are moving to. That's one aspect. The aspect of the specific professions which are suffering the most in terms of immigration is teaching, number one, with approximately 11,000 skilled South Africans moving in a single year. And then you have general managers, the life sciences and health professionals moving a lot, legislators moving to the Czech Republic, experts in physical science and mathematics, engineering moving to the Czech Republic. So these are, I think the one that's really striking is the teaching fraternity, which is suffering the most in terms of immigration. The third point I wanted to make is that, you know, if you just look at the factors which our forefathers may have looked at when it came to immigration, and you look at the same factors now, in my personal view, it does seem like immigration is no longer just a solution as it was maybe 40, maybe 50, 100 years ago. It may have been a solution for the individuals back then, but immigration currently is really not a solution. If you just consider the world situation, and the very purpose of mine and your existence as Muslims, are we in this world for the taking or for the giving? That's the difference we have to make. Are we here to give or are we here to take? And immigration, in many cases, not all cases, in many cases, is all about taking. It's all about your own personal interest and your own family's personal interest versus the nation building and the aspect of contributing to the lives of others in a consistent manner, which is in keeping with the Quran and the Sunnah of our Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam.
Okay. Mufti Saab Jazakallah for that. That brings us to the end of this week's discussion on BizWeek Consumer Highlights. We now go for the second segment of our program, Business for Beginners.
Business for Beginners on the Atajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Mufti Saab, this week on Business for Beginners, something very interesting that we wanted to discuss. We basically have two questions, two different parts of it. What is the difference, firstly, between a parastatal and a state-owned enterprise? And then what is the relevance of understanding the difference?
Your question is very relevant in terms of the difference between a parastatal and a state-owned enterprise. So we are in Business for Beginners, in which we are unpacking the world of business and economics for those who are just beginners and for those to whom these words are just strange terminologies, you know. I find it quite surprising that even experts, journalists, also make this mistake in terms of making a differentiation between a parastatal and a state-owned enterprise. These are two separate words and two separate definitions, two individual definitions. This information that I'm citing here is broadly from an article which appeared in the mainstream print media, authored by a very famous economist, Pierre Hastings. And he talks about the state-owned enterprise defined as a private company where the government is a major shareholder. So it's a private company where the government is the major shareholder. It's not the sole shareholder. There are other shareholders, but the government itself is a major shareholder. Now, we have approximately 130 state-owned enterprises in South Africa, and examples of state-owned enterprises include Danel, Telkom. These companies basically operate and generate their own kind of revenue to support themselves. So it's revenue for the company itself, and in the process of doing their day-to-day business, the company supports itself. State-owned enterprises are a very important component of just about any economy, and in our specific case, they account for approximately 10% of our GDP, which is derived on an annual basis. So it is an important component of measuring growth of an economy, although growth is very slow in the country, but it usually accounts for about 10% of growth in GDP in terms of the South African context. So the state-owned enterprise is a private company where the government is just a major shareholder. A parastatal, as opposed to a state-owned enterprise, is a legal entity which is created by the government to undertake commercial activity on behalf of the government. Naturally, this would mean that the government is the sole owner of the specific entity that one is referring to. So a parastatal is generally referring to a state-owned enterprise in which the government is the sole owner. And I'm subject to correction on this one, but if I recall correctly, SABC would qualify as an example of a parastatal for the mere fact that it is solely owned by the government. This is the difference between a state-owned enterprise and a parastatal. In terms of your second question, Marana, was about the relevance of understanding the difference. Is that correct?
Okay. Understanding, once we have differentiated the difference between a parastatal and a state-owned enterprise, and what is the relevance of understanding this difference?
The relevance is more because very recently, Marana, the Department of Trade and Industry recently said that all state-owned enterprises should source the inputs or products from at least 70% of the inputs should be produced locally. Mm. That's basically the relevance. Now, it does sound very nice that all the state enterprises must source at least 70% of the inputs locally, and rather than having to import it. It sounds very good and sounds very, very noble. Mm. What they're requesting is recommending is basically something called localization. In economic terms, it's about sourcing all your inputs to produce a finished product locally rather than importing something. It sounds good because if you think about it, Mona, it boosts domestic production because whatever was imported at some point in time now has to be produced locally, and obviously that local production is increasing. It goes without saying that if local production is increasing, naturally there are more jobs because more people are engaged in trying to produce the inputs which are required by the state-owned enterprise to carry out its function. Naturally, there would be more investment in factories. People will be putting more money into the local industry to develop the local industry more specifically. And another maybe good spin-off is that usually when you're importing items, one is exposed to to the exchange rate risk, you know, this fluctuation in the rand, dollar, all of these different currencies. Whereas if items are sourced locally, one reduces the exposure to exchange rate risk. But the reason why it's a bit difficult for the TTI to just simply be requesting that state-owned enterprises source items locally is because some of the items that are required by the state-owned enterprises are simply just not available locally. Mm-hmm. If you just look at the simple example of the National Archives, the software alone which is required by the National Archives is something which is involves tremendous capital outlay. And if South Africa were to alone produce the software locally, there's only one customer. There's only the state that has to buy that specific software. There's no other customer for it. And how does that company that is involved in developing its software then generate some kind of revenue? There's only one customer. And then it goes without saying that if everything has to be sourced locally, and it's such a high cost to produce the things locally, the cost is eventually borne by the ordinary taxpayer, you and I. So we have to then bear the cost of producing these inputs locally. So it does then make a case for having some items are required locally. Other items, it is in some cases mandatory to be importing them, and not all of it can be produced locally. So that's basically the relevance why it's important to understand this difference between a state-owned enterprise and a parastato.
Okay, Jazakallah for that, Mufti Saab. That is a very, very detailed discussion, a very, very, very simple, but a very, very important difference that you have mentioned. And as you said, many people don't often differentiate between these two, the parastatal and the state-owned enterprise. I think we've completed now the second segment of our program. We have one segment, Chair.
Just before we proceed, I forgot to raise two aspects which featured last week. One is that somebody asked about the aspect of offshore investing. And just for the benefit of that individual and anyone else who may have been listening at that time, the principle of investing offshore, as I mentioned last week, is from an Islamic perspective, it is permissible to invest offshore. It is fine. But one has to keep in mind the local regulations in terms of investing offshore. So keep in mind that South Africa has a residence-based tax system, which means that an individual has to pay tax in this country on assets irrespective of where in the world those assets are. So one has to be, that's what it means when you say South Africa has a residence-based tax system. In terms of the law, as long as an individual is entitled to take up to 10 million rand offshore as a foreign investment allowance and 1 million annually for any purpose, including travel and investment. So these are just... This is just a tip of the iceberg in terms of what the regulations are. So in investing abroad from an Islamic perspective may be clear. It has to be Islamically compliant and also compliant with the local authorities and their tax system. That was the first aspect which needed some addressing in terms of last week. And then during the week, we received a request to touch on the ethics of utilizing services or platforms like Airbnb, which is used for your accommodation and your vacations, as well as the ethics of using Uber, the transport platform. So that's something which I need to look into maybe and do some research. I have been obtaining a few articles in the week, and we'll probably touch on those on that aspect in due course, inshallah.
Inshallah, Jazakallah for that, Mufti Saab. That brings us to the final segment now of our program. Before we go to the segment itself, I think there's first a ad break that we'll have to take. We'll ask our engineer Osama to play the adverts, and then we will be back to stay tuned. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It is gone 18 minutes left to the hour of 10. We do, with the Sister Atajir program, in this program we're discussing various business, economics and financial issues. We have one segment of our program left. We do remind the listeners, if there's anything on your mind, if it is business, economics or finance related, then you can send us an SMS or WhatsApp 083-379-4235. Alternatively, you could even call us here directly at the studio 011-854-1548. We now start off with the final segment of our program, which is Fiqh of Commerce.
Fiqh of Commerce on the Atajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Mufti Saab, just a recap of last week. We discussed, it was actually I think rule number 8 where we discussed, we're discussing the rules of leasing, and we have been discussing the rule with regards to providing meals. Is it part of the contract or not, etc.?
Manana, in terms of a nutshell of last week's discussion, the aspect is very relevant in terms of whether an individual under one's employ is entitled to meals during the period of employment. So in the ordinary case of, say, example, a painter or plumber or even a domestic, you know, are they entitled to meals or not? And in last week's segment, we had taken a look at the aspect mentioning that We have two separate systems now that we've got to consider in providing a response. One is the Sharia-based aspect of it, and the other is the South African legal requirement. So from a Sharia perspective, which is the area where we are allowed and to comment, is the aspect of the fact that this matter is very much left to what the prevailing norm is in society. So if you take a simple thing like a plumber coming to your house, the norm in society is that they're just coming for that odd job, and they're going to leave the premises. You know, if they happen to stay very long, because the problem, the nature of the problem is so complex, one is not usually obliged to provide anything. Whereas in the case of a domestic, maybe the fact that the person is there for the whole day, they may be entitled to, you may be feeling that the norm in society is that to give them meals for the duration that they are in your employ. So in that case, it may be recommended to do it. So the Sharia doesn't, in essence, put down a strict rule that it must be provided or must not be provided. It's very much left up to the prevailing norm in society. And then obviously for a legal approach, we need to be contacting the Labour Line, which is also on Radio Islam International. And the relevant professionals can maybe comment on the South African legal requirement. But from a Sharia perspective, in essence, it's very much left to the overall practice in society, which determines the outcome of this kind of matter. And also, if I recall correctly, we talked about the aspect of sometimes there are obligations, and then one has to also look at what is the mark of generosity. You know, when it comes to these kind of matters, we don't really stick to rules all the time. The Sharia doesn't preclude and prevent us from exercising a degree of generosity and saying, even though I don't have to do it, I'm willing to do it for the sake of my specific employee.
Jim, definitely that is very, very important, that generosity aspect. You know, it's when it comes to these things, we shouldn't only be looking at rules and laws, and our heart should speak louder than those rules and laws. One point is, you know, sometimes what happens in certain cases is we hire a person and we agree that we're going to pay them maybe 50 rand for washing the car, cleaning the yard, whatever the job and the service might be, and then we happen to give them something to eat during the day. Maybe it's like cleaning the yard, it's taking a few hours, and then we give them something to eat, and then when it comes to pay time, then we, if we agreed 50 rand, we maybe give them 40 rand, and the guy looks at you and you tell him that, no, you know what, I gave you something to eat, I gave you some bread, some food, whatever it might be. Obviously that is not allowed, right?
Very relevant question, and it does happen in practice, Mona. It's from a Sharia perspective, it is not tolerable to adopt that kind of practice. If one has agreed to a specific figure of a cash amount, that cash amount has to be provided, and the meals or something to eat is generally regarded as a measure of generosity. And something which is provided out of the goodness of your heart and just out of sheer mercy for the individual, whether the individual requires it or not, you know. So it's two different aspects, and they should not be brought together in an individual contract where you're saying, I've reduced the actual amount of cash that I'm paying you or compensating you because I gave you or did this other favor for you, you know.
All right, this week we're going to take a look at Rule 9, the Islamic legal status of the lease asset while it remains in the possession of the tenant of the lessee. So that's the important part here, that the asset is still in the possession of the tenant and the lessee. What is the Islamic legal status of that asset?
It is important to address this rule of what is the Islamic status, because it does have consequences, and it does impact on the final outcome in the event of things going out of the ordinary, you know. So in short, the Islamic legal status of the item while it's in the possession of the tenant or lessee is that of an amana. It's a trust. Now, I'm using the word trust as a loose translation of amana, and I must mention and digress a little bit here that these words in the commercial industry have become such an amazing thing, in the sense that they have dual meanings, because they have meanings in our day-to-day lives and then they have meaning in the world of commerce. So just to give you simple examples, right, you have words like vanilla. Vanilla means something in our kitchen context, right? But in the world of commerce, vanilla has a meaning on its own. You say a vanilla bond. A vanilla bond means a financial instrument which is very generic and very general. Just as vanilla in the kitchen is very general, a vanilla bond is a very general kind of financial instrument. And then you talk of investment horizons, you know. We have an horizon in our world, and then we have a horizon in the commercial interest. Also options. I mean, I have an option to do something, I have an option to tick or not tick, or to take this item or not take it. But then in the world of commerce, an option is a very loaded term and it has its own meaning. Similarly, swaps, I swap my phone with you. But a swap in the commercial context is a financial instrument on its own. So in the same light, I'm just referring to an amana, loosely translating an amana as a trust. Because if you talk of trust in the legal context, it has a meaning. And you talk of trust between myself and yourself in our relationship, you know. So these words are very loaded. But there are consequences. When you say that the least effort in the possession of the tenant or lessee is in the Islamic legal status is that of a trust, there are consequences. And I'll mention them here very quickly. The first consequence of it is that even if the landlord or the lessor says that irrespective of what happens to this item while it is in your possession, you have to settle whatever costs are incurred by virtue of this specific item. So I'm leasing you my motor vehicle. Whatever happens to it, whether it meets up, someone bumps into you, or the item or the motor vehicle is stolen, irrespective of what happens, you would have to compensate me. In this kind of scenario, even though the lessor has put this kind of condition in place, when you say that the Islamic legal status is that of a trust, it means that if that user of the motor vehicle was not negligent in using the motor vehicle, he was just parked off at a robot and someone came and ran right into his back, you know, so and smashed the motor vehicle. In that case, there was absolutely no negligence on behalf of the user. The lessor, even though he or she stipulated that you will be responsible for all these expenses, and that user of the motor vehicle will not be responsible by virtue of the Islamic legal status of holding that item being that of a trust. It's in good faith that you're holding that item, and you, only if there's negligence on behalf of the user, in that case can the user be held responsible for any kind of negligence. Similarly, another consequence of regarding that item as a trust is that if the item is lost or damaged beyond use, during the period of the lease agreement, the compensation which is required for the remainder of the agreement is not due anymore, because you're regarding it as a trust. So in that example of a motor vehicle, if the motor vehicle was leased for 6 months and you're using the motor vehicle on a day-to-day basis, if someone smashed into it through no negligence of the user of the motor vehicle, in that case, the remaining period, let's say there's 2 months left for the lease agreement, that does not have to be paid for by the user of the motor vehicle. That's another consequence of regarding this item in their possession, in the user's possession, as a trust. So I hope these two consequences clearly demonstrate what the consequences are of saying that the item in the hands of the user is that of a trust. If I give just a few more examples, if you'll allow me.
Sure, no problem.
One is, which is very common, is the scenario of when you, let's say you're having a function at home and you lease some dishes. Mm. So you've got all this cutlery at home and it's leased from someone else. So you're paying a fee for using those items. And now something breaks. And it breaks purely out of no negligence of the user. In that case, if there was absolutely no negligence, the individual cannot be held liable for having lost or broken some of those dishes if it was damaged for some reason. Obviously, if the user of the utensils and cutlery was negligent, instead of letting an adult hold a whole stack of plates, gave it to a small child and a small child dropped it, you know. Mm. In that case, it's up to the user of the cutlery to clear disclose that we need to pay for this, for these broken dishes, you know. Mm-hmm. And you find this in the domestic example. Even in our day-to-day lives, we find our domestics, you know, sometimes out of just no negligence of this, they break a glass or break a plate, and then you find the employer is screaming at them and penalizing them and deducting an amount from the wages, you know. There are circumstances and there are circumstances. We need to look into them individually. But I'm just saying in general, sometimes we've got to take into account whether there was negligence or no negligence. In destroying a leased item. Another example is the aspect of, let's say I recently encountered this example in our office queries, where you gave your Quran or your book for binding. Mm. But the day you gave it to the binding, to the individual who carries out these services, you gave it with a cover and everything else. And it so happens that the day you go and collect your binded Quran or your book, you find that the cover is missing. But the individual didn't exercise any negligence. There wasn't any malified or bad intention to make sure that they deprive you of the cover of your book or Quran. In that case, they cannot be held responsible for that kind of loss. So these are just a few examples, and I hope they demonstrate that the least asset in the hands of the user, of the lessee, is that of an amana or what we loosely translate is a trust in the hands of the user.
Okay. Well, Sab, that very, very important, and you know, as the examples that you had cited in there, some of them very relevant, the example that you had cited of the domestic worker, and sometimes we don't realize the implications. And the point is, when you are hiring the person, then Muftisab had very clearly explained that this is the Islamic legal status. Is the law of the country any different from the Islamic legal status?
In this regard, it's very much similar, and I find quite a few similarities in terms of what I know of the law after having studied it, and what I know of the Islamic side. You know, the similarities are glaring, and they are quite, in fact, in many cases, just what I could say, a carbon copy of what we find in Islamic law. And the mere fact that Islamic law prevailed before the modern day legal system does demonstrate that many of our rules have actually fed into these. The prevailing legal systems and have been modified to suit the mind in the modern world, and there are many other principles that I could extract, especially in family law or even the laws of inheritance, sometimes commercial law for that matter, that actually are a carbon copy in terms of what we find in the law today and what we have had for so many centuries in our Islam and in our Islamic system of law.
Because I think, you know, if the two are very different, then when you're hiring the person, then which one do you exactly go with? I mean, do you take the Islamic status or do you take the law of the country? And it could sometimes lead to an argument.
Yes, by and large, it's a very relevant question you raised there, and the aspect of merging the two is in many cases possible, in the sense that both are geared towards achieving some kind of protection for both parties. In some cases, it will differ, but broadly speaking, both systems will seek to protect the interests of both parties who are involved in that contract. So it is possible. I haven't come across many cases where there's been a major divergence between the two systems. I'm sure there are, but it would take some doing or searching to find those areas where a specific practice would be in conflict. On one hand, you have Islamic rule of employment, and the other, the Roman law or the South African legal system.
Okay, JazakAllah for that, Mufti Sab. There's just 3 minutes left before the hour of 10. We thank you. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you in abundance for availing your time and availing your expertise on these different matters.
I mean, JazakAllah, it has been a pleasure, Mulana, and I do look forward to another segment. I make dua to Allah Ta'ala that they accept this one. And if there is anything which is unclear, I welcome the listeners to contact me on the office telephone number, which is 011-373-8000.
JazakAllah for that, Mufti Sab. For that, we terminate this week's program. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make it a means of benefit for each and every one of us. JazakAllah for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.